Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening and welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and tonight my co-host is going to be Dr. Kate. I need to let everyone know that Red Beckman had a little bit of complication as a follow-up to his open-heart surgery, and so he went and checked himself back in to the hospital for a little bit of additional work. He actually had some fluid that had built up around his lung, about 3 liters worth of it. And so they had to go in with a needle, and he's breathing a whole lot better tonight and feeling a lot better, and I hope he's listening to us. Don't believe he'll be able to join us. Don't even know if he made it home today or not from the hospital, but I know that he was certainly wanting to go home. He's a guy that likes to stay busy and stay moving, and I'm just glad that he's feeling better after them getting all that fluid gone. Kate, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, evening. Good evening, Terry. How are you?
That sounds like Kurt McKenzie.
And he is on.
It sounds like Kurt.
I will be in the background.
Well, Kate, Kirk, we like to open up tonight with a prayer, and especially since our friend Red Beckman is having his health issues, I certainly want to pray for Red. So, if you don't mind, I'm just going to open us up. Heavenly Father, I just I'm so thankful for this day. I'm thankful for the opportunity to share, good people like Kirk McKenzie and our other guests tonight. And it's great to have Dr. Kate covering for Red tonight. And just thankful that your healing hand has been on Red, and that you've been watching over him and making certain that the doctors do the right things. And I'm thankful that he doesn't have any pneumonia or known infection at this point. And just thank you, Father, and pray that you would continue his recovery and watch over him while he's not here with us tonight, and watch over us, because Red keeps us in line, Father, and he keeps us mindful of you, and we hope that your spirit will go before us in everything that we do and say tonight, and just pray that what we do is in your will. And the name of Yeshua, we pray. Amen. Well, Kurt McKenzie, welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I'm not even sure where to start tonight, Kirk. I hope, you've done a lot of radio, and you've got a lot of people listening tonight that are going to hear you probably for the first time. So you might want to start out by giving us a little bit of history on who Kirk McKenzie is, how you came to write your book, and you got so interested in this topic that you're so eloquent and concise and straightforward with explaining in a way that I think Joe Sixpack can get it. And so very appreciative of what you've done. And I just want to give you the floor and maybe tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you. I'll try and keep it brief. You look back over your life and try and figure out what brings you to the point you are. I guess I will start with the fact that I'm a son of a career Air Force colonel. And I guess if you cut me open, I bleed red, white, and blue. And I believe in our nation, and I believe in the original founding principles. I'm a technology guy by background. I have degrees in electrical engineering and a master's of business administration, and I worked at some of the major technology firms in engineering and management positions and ultimately top management positions. And I first got off the couch about 20 years ago, very concerned about the debt, and became Ross Perot's California State Chair for United We Stand America. Now, this was not the election part. It was the after that he was starting a grassroots organization to make a difference. And following that period of time, I just continued my research. And I think, like many, I had spent the first part of my life listening to the daily news, keep hearing the same stuff over and over again, but somehow just believing if we could just talk to our representative and explain how the world works, or if, you know, they don't quite get it, or they're, you know, just they're making mistakes, you know, I can help solve the problems. And I think eventually you have to abandon that and understand, no, we're the ones that don't get it. They understand these things, and somebody is driving us in the direction we're going for a reason. And so I decided to conduct my own independent investigation. And in that 20-year period of time, there's hardly any topic I have not studied in great detail. And what I came to realize is ultimately it doesn't matter where you start. If you study it long enough, whether it's education or global warming or, you know, healthcare, whatever, you ultimately come back to discovering that there is a family, often called international bankers, where they are at the middle of all this, and what empowers them and gives them the ability to do all this is the fact that they control the money. And so my conclusion was, well, excuse me, how do you get your hands around this? How do we get a country back? And my conclusion on this is that money is so foundational to their power. If you took everything else away, but you left them this power, it all come back. And my personal conclusion is that ultimately, if we are to succeed, we must reform our monetary system. It's not optional. It's difficult, but it's not optional. And therefore, I decided to start putting together all the research I had come up with over a 20-year period of time. They're trying to simplify it and synthesize it so somebody who knows nothing about the topic can walk into it in a pretty neutral way and just walk through the story, walk through the facts, and see for themselves and come to discover why this is so important and so essential, and then also give some ideas on, you know, how you solve these problems and what people can do to help. And so that's what really kind of led me to do this.
Well, Kurt, let me interject at this point, because the timing of me learning about you and finding your seminars and especially you sending me your book, which I really appreciate, by the way,
sure,
is so perfect. The timing of it is perfect, and the reason it is because it's been challenging for me, even though I knew that Dr. Edwin Vieira's work, for example, is very, very important, and I knew that our currency was important. It was difficult to explain to people why it's a prerequisite to get proprietary ownership of our money back before we can go out and do any kind of judicial reform or have any means of enforcing common law or, you know, any of these other things that we need to do to restore the sovereignty of our states and to take our power back from this, what Red and I call a federal false god. It's difficult to explain to people why the first thing that you really need to do is to get some sound money legislation going in your state and building a wall between the rights of the individual and this police state, you know, that comes out of this banking cartel that controls our federal government. And your videos, your online videos are fantastic. Your book is fantastic, and it provides a tool for people like me who are out here pushing this as a solution, as a first step in a solution. Obviously, there's a lot more to the solution than just that. But I sincerely believe that you have hit on and struck on the absolute prerequisite before we can do anything else to cure the problem. So that's why it's so perfect timing for me. So I'll give the floor back to you.
Well, I certainly appreciate the fact that, you know, you say this, because this is actually what I tried to do. You know, I've read a lot of my work is built on the backs of the shoulders of a lot of other great people. You know, I think one of the first to talk about these issues was Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins. There was actually a book written back in 1882 called The Catechism of the Financial Legislation from 1862 to 1882. There's a book called The Coming Battle written in 1899. I mean, there's a lot of people, G. Edward Griffin, of course, a lot of people, and I've read a lot of material. But for some reason for me is that they never quite grasped, I could never quite grasp exactly how the system worked, exactly how it impacted me. And then once you get into understanding it, is to simplify it for everybody else. And I reached the conclusion that I think that the way that the monetary problems are being explained by most of the people who have gotten us to this point appeal to people like myself, who I would consider to be people who are pretty independent thinkers, we're willing to intellectually cross the taboos and consider, you know, viewpoints that might not by others be considered to be outside the mainstream in the search for truth. And so we're willing to tolerate, you know, look for people whose names we don't know, who may speak in a voice that's somewhat angry because, you know, they understand it and now they're pretty upset talking about it. And I came to the realization that that works for, you know, the pioneers. But now we have to influence public opinion broadly. And for that group of people, they simply cannot, you know, accept the fact of conspiracies and Jekyll Island, and frankly, all this is really not essential to what the message that we have to communicate. What they can understand, is what it does to them personally. And I think that that was the goal that I had, was to basically provide an on-ramp into the topic and bring together everything you really need to know about this, the system, and do it in a way that was clear, simple, and illustrated. You know, the book, you know, has a very unique layout. The left page and the right page actually function as a single page. The text on one side, an illustration on the other side, and this is page after page after page. And that was my intent, and then I, of course, then took the content of the book to use to build some YouTube videos, which people are welcome to watch, which have the advantage of having animation added to them. The disadvantage that they don't have all the same level of depth as the book does, but again, with the same goal, is to try and get a broader base of people to really get it in their gut what this means to them. And I believe that by doing so, then the elections will take care of themselves, because people will then understand who to vote for. I think we do more to change the votes by informing people of the facts and letting them make their own decisions, rather than telling, you know, 2 days before the vote, you know, get out and vote, here's who you vote for. I think it's more useful to actually educate people and change public opinion. And that becomes a more, I think, effective and ultimately a more permanent way to go about this.
Indeed. I don't know if you want to, where in your book, or if you really want to try to kind of enlighten people. You know, you get into the stuff about vapors, and I think that's where most people probably start kind of wondering what they've been thinking all their life. Because it's pretty clear for the average guy, but, you know, we walk through this life, I know I did, a majority of my life without thinking about these things, and we've been so victimized by the whole panem et circenses principle, this bread and circuses that we've been led to believe is a normal way of life, where we get to a point where if we're well-fed and we're entertained enough, we simply ignore all the matters of state. And so we don't think about these things. We don't focus on the things. So we've abdicated all of this, and it's gotten us in now what we can see is a tremendous amount of trouble. So I'm thinking that, you know, if you could share maybe something out of your book or out of your seminar series that I know you do, that would just kind of give the people a taste for what they can learn.
Well, I'd be happy to. I mean, I can give you a quick overview in the book, and then I can take a couple of relevant points. The book has 6 chapters. Frankly, it's all you need. The first chapter explains the concepts behind our monetary system. And, you know, we hear the terms, but it actually explains in the way you finally get it. And we'll talk about one of those in a second. Chapter 4 of the book then tells you the implications of that to you personally. What's that doing in terms of really destroying the American dream and your opportunity for yourself and your children and your grandchildren? Chapters 2 and 3 work together to explain how this system has been built brick by brick from the founding of our country forward, essentially how the constitutional principles have been overthrown. Because when I was a student, I hated history, but I'll tell you what I've come to really understand. Our future is going to be determined by how well we understand our history. And so absolutely fascinating information. If you're into suspense novels or mystery novels or those kind of things, I guarantee you the monetary history of the United States is far more interesting than any of those books. I present it in a pretty factual way, but I think that the implications of what you're reading will just absolutely fly off the page. And then the final two sections are chapters 5 and 6, which basically address some proposals on how to solve the problems and then what people can do individually to help out. As far as some concepts to share, I think the first thing would probably be to understand is really we don't have money. I mean, we use the term money because that's what we've been told, that's how we think, but money is really, I think, what you call a commodity money. It really is something of some intrinsic value. We don't really have that. And secondarily, it's really not dollars. A dollar is 371 and a quarter was grains of silver. It is a coin. It is not a piece of paper. And perhaps another aspect of this is that most of our money, 90% of the, quote, money in our country is not even Federal Reserve notes. It's not even paper. It's basically just ones and zeros floating around in a computer program, what I call the matrix. And they're nothing more than, you know, ones and zeros floating around in this big Quicken program that has no physical reality. I mean, it has no existence in the real world. It's just kind of out there. And yet it's controlling our lives. So probably the first thing to understand is this thing called debt monetization. When a person goes to say, get a mortgage on a home, the word mortgage comes from French. Mort stands for death, and gods stands for pledge. And we generally have the perception that what we're going to do is borrow somebody else's savings, because that's what we've been told. It's false, but that's what we've been told. And you go into your bank, and they say, well, we're prepared to loan you some money for two things. First, you're going to sign a mortgage. And by that mortgage, what you're going to do is agree to work for us for 30 years. Now, we don't normally think of it that way, but in fact, that's what you're doing. You're basically saying you're going to give a portion of your labor to the bank for 30 years. And the second thing you do is you agree that they're going to hold effective title to your house. You know, we think of ourselves as homeowners, but don't make a couple payments and you quickly discover who's the real homeowner. And so with those two things, your labor for 30 years, and effectively what that means is you have now become an indentured servant. A mortgage is a form of indentured servitude. You become their indentured servant, and you've given them effective title to your home, but they have no obligation to protect it, to pay for insurance, to pull out the weeds. I mean, you have all the obligations of ownership, but you don't, in fact, have ownership. And they take all the profits. So you give them those two things, and then what they do is they essentially go into the Quicken program, and they create a debit and a credit that never existed before. They create electronic money out of thin air. It doesn't exist. It's not somebody else's money. They just give you a loan. So, in fact, what we now think of as money is nothing more than evidence of somebody's debt. And that could be the federal government, state government, the corporation, or a person, but it's nothing but evidence of a debt. That's debt monetization. Now, there's a couple pretty clear implications of debt monetization. For a nation's wealth to grow, the money supply has to grow. But under a monopolistic, debt-monetized monetary system such as we have today, the only way for the monetary supply to grow is somebody borrows it. The banks will not issue this into circulation unless somebody goes into debt. Therefore, to grow the nation, you have to grow the debt. Another implication is if you try and pay down the debt, you're going to implode the money supply. When you pay off a mortgage, you've actually extinguished those credits and debits. You have effectively reduced the money supply. So we're sitting here electing people to Congress who are telling us that they're going to get to Washington, D.C., and they're going to tackle the debt problem, and they're going to be good boys, and they're going to do, and girls, and do what, you know, we want. And I think a lot of them are intending to do that. And they have no understanding whatsoever of the monetary system and how it truly functions. It is impossible to pay off the debts of this nation without imploding our economy. The only choice is we must change the monetary system itself. We cannot continue under this system. Now, to give an understanding, perhaps another tangible understanding what this means, we have not paid off the debts from the Civil War. We're still paying usury for the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and on and on and on. And in fact, we have not had a government surplus since 1957. That means there's three generations of people in our country who don't even know what a government surplus means. And the debt is increasing at an astronomical and geometrically progressing rate. It is unsustainable. And when indentured servitude, when debt becomes permanent, it is now bondage. And we are a nation of people who are in bondage. And our federal government deficit spending is putting us there, in addition to our own borrowing and the fact that we have a monetary system that gives us the money that can only be borrowed. It is absolutely phenomenal. It is crazy. It is a system designed to empower and in wealth the few who pull the strings, basically the Wizard of Oz, some little small man behind a screen pulling this lever and controlling everybody else. It is the mechanism for controlling the world, and that is fully their intent. And it is so critical that people just begin to understand these simple concepts, how the system is working, how it becomes completely self-defeating to our future, and begin to put some time and effort into turning it around.
Well, you might explain to the folks about who owns the currency today.
The Federal Reserve Banks are privately owned corporations. They're not government agencies. They're no more federal than Federal Express. You know, somebody can pick up the phone book and go to the federal government pages and try and find a listing for Federal Reserve Bank. You won't find it. They're privately owned corporations, and they operate for the benefit of the banks and their regions. And just like any corporation, they're there to enrich their shareholders, not the American people. And so their objective is to enrich and empower the bankers, not the people. Now, the Federal Reserve Board, which is also a private organization, effectively acts as a cabal because it allows the 12 banks, the independent Federal Reserve banks, to get together and collude on interest rates and terms and so forth. The real power structure of the whole system resides in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the banks which own it, which are the New York banks. But it's all privately owned and has been since the beginning. And according to some estimates, at least 40% and even more, perhaps even more than half, of the control of the ownership of the Federal Reserve banks is in foreign hands.
Well, what about everybody's bank account? Do they when that's in the deposit and held by the bank, do the people own that money?
When they make deposits in the bank?
Yeah.
Well, the money itself is a debt monetized currency. Now they have a credit in the accounting system, and so as long as somebody else will accept that, then you can utilize it as money. I mean, you have an interest in that. Now here's another part of the problem. And that's what we know as inflation. So anything that you hold in the shape of either Federal Reserve notes or bank accounts or even stock accounts where you have the stock in the brokerage company in a house account are all measured in this thing called dollars, suggesting that they have some kind of constant value. In fact, the value of that dollar, quote-unquote dollar, is always going down. And so your money is actually sliding down the hill. Your real purchasing value is sliding down the hill, and intentionally, because by an inflationary policy and by taking away your property when you die through the death tax, it pretty much perpetuates the system. So here's how inflation works, and here's perhaps a simple way to understand this. Most people have, at one point in their time, owned stock in a company. So what's the value of one share? And the answer is the value of one share is the value of the company divided by the number of shares. So you have a thing on a piece of paper that says one share, and you could go lock that into the biggest vault in the world for a year, and there you have this one share. However, if the company does a two-for-one stock split, for example, that one share still says one share, and nobody's touched it. It's still sitting in that bank vault, but now it's actually worth half. You know, if it was worth $10 per share, now it's worth $5 per share. The only reason you don't complain is that you get a second share. So now you have two shares, so you essentially exchange the 10 for two fives. You haven't been harmed. But the monetary system works in the very same fashion. When the money supply goes up without any offsetting production of real wealth, then it's basically just like stock that's being diluted. The value of that currency is being diluted. And effectively, you're being robbed of your labor with it almost invisibly and without your understanding or, you know, any kind of involvement in the decision process to do that. So inflation usually is thought of with people as the increase in prices. But the reason the prices increase is not that the, you know, a Snickers candy bar when I was a boy was 5 cents. And I remember so clearly my dad buying a Plymouth station wagon for our family, a family car, and he was so upset about the price because it got to be $1,000. Now, those two things have not really intrinsically have any more value. So, but today, a Snickers candy bar costs $1.25 and the family car costs $25,000. It's not because they're more valuable. It's because this currency that we have, this quote-unquote dollar, has become worth less by approximately 25 times. Now, if you were to look at the price of a car in Snickers bars at 5 cents apiece, a $1,000 car would cost me 20,000 Snickers bars. Today, at about a buck and a quarter apiece, 20,000 Snickers bars will still buy me a car. So when you start looking at real things compared to real things, you know, whether it's a bucket of wheat, a gallon of milk, a gallon of oil, dozen eggs, you know, whatever is relevant to you if you're, you know, a rancher, pounds of meat, and you look at what it takes in terms of pounds of meat or ounces of gold to buy a home, you discover there's a remarkable stability in the price of things when measured in other real things. The only thing that's dropping in value is the currency. And so it is really this devaluation of the dollar that's behind inflation. And so it's more accurate to think of inflation not as an increase in prices, but a devaluation of the currency that's intentionally accomplished through bank policy and federal government's approval.
Well, no, I know that they use the inflation and the deflation to rip us off, to steal our wealth. Can you kind of explain how that can work?
Sure. I mean, let's suppose that you're a banker today, you have a zero interest rate. I mean, your money is free. You can borrow for free. Isn't that wonderful? When the cost of borrowing is relatively cheap, people borrow a lot, and so they go into debt. And I'll take an example. Back in 1916, the federal government passed some legislation that encouraged farmers to go into debt. the farmers at that point in time were actually doing pretty well. They were fairly prosperous, and the federal government said, hey, why don't you expand your operations, buy more land, buy more equipment, and we'll give you the money and let you borrow it. And the money was on favorable terms. Well, they all got into debt, and then what happened? The banks raised the interest rates, and they began to change the terms of loaning, and they started to basically what they call tighten. This happens in 1920 and 1921. This is referred to as the Agricultural Depression or the Forgotten Depression. And they do it only against the farms, not against everybody else, and just when the crops are ready for harvest. The farms across the nation go bankrupt. This is the era of Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde were popular heroes because the bankers across the nation were coming back and reclaiming the private property from the people. And it's all done through a financial manipulation whereby you get people in debt, and then once you have them in debt, you tighten, and X percentage of the people are going to fail. That creates the cycles. Now, they've led us to believe these are somehow economic cycles. There's some kind of a mismatch between production and consumption that creates these cycles, and that they're chasing these cycles, trying to prevent them by controlling interest rates and everything else. Baloney. They create these cycles. Milton, in 1932, Congressman Lewis T. McFadden says on the record, in the congressional record, that the Great Depression was caused by the Federal Reserve banks. It turns out that Milton and Anna Friedman later studied the Great Depression in some detail and reached the same conclusion. And so did Ben Bernanke. In a speech in 2002, at the end of his speech, he acknowledged, yep, we did it. We're sorry, but we did it. Now, we're sorry doesn't cut it for me, because I had grandparents and parents that lived through those days. In effect, in Russia, they were taking private property through revolution. In the United States, they were taking it via depression, starting with farmlands in 1920 and 1921, and then the Great Depression started to take over the home properties. And then in 1933, FDR confiscates the gold and the gold certificates and gives us worthless Federal Reserve notes, and then devalues the Federal Reserve notes by 40%. People really need to understand just the basic simples, simple things about a monetary system, because what you've been told and what you believe are not true, and is ultimately the thing that is destroying us. So these cycles are created by bank policy. They're not created by some kind of problem with capitalism.
Are you aware of what Obama's grandmother and mother eventually were involved in with the microfinance schemes?
No, I'm aware of it, but not to any great depth.
Well, it's my belief, just from doing the research, that this is precisely how Obama was discovered as a child, and how he got in with the likes of the Brzezinskis and the George Soroses, whose real name is Georgie Schwartz. But these international bank lords got to know little Obama because his grandmother, if it was his grandmother, and his mother eventually, when she was in Indonesia, got involved in managing microfinance. Well, microfinance, well, first of all, let's talk about his grandmother. She started out at the Bank of Hawaii as a teller, and just within a couple of months, she became an executive vice president of the bank. I mean, anybody that's knows anything knows that just doesn't happen. Well, why did it happen? Well, she was involved in microfinance, and she was managing large amounts of funds for these international bank people, and they were going out and they were lending money to third world farmers, knowing full well that these farmers would never be able to pay it back and that they would be able to steal their land. Mm-hmm. And when Grandma Obama retired, Ann Dunham, while she was over in Indonesia, started doing the microfinance, the same thing that her mother was doing at the Bank of Hawaii. And I believe this is exactly how Obama got in with all of these international bank people and why he's their fall guy. I mean, he came in and slick tongue and using neuro-linguistic patterns and all sorts of things to con people into electing him. And I'm not so sure that they didn't even manipulate the vote. But the point is that this is who he's worked for. This is who his family has worked for since he was a child.
Well, you know, that I hadn't heard that particular angle, but, you know, it could very well be true. I mean, I would agree completely that he and in fact, many presidents are frankly nothing more than front people for the banking power that behind the throne. I mean, all the power in this country resides in New York City. It's not in Washington, D.C. I mean, just look. I mean, just take an aerial photo on Google and look at the wealth of that city and then comprehend the fact there's no production, no manufacturing, no farms, you know, no healthcare industry. I mean, nothing. And some years ago, I did a study, and I found out that 40% of the profits of the nation are essentially under the financial institutions, you know, banks, insurance companies, and brokerage companies. You can take all the rest of the United States, farming, ranching, mining, all the good people out in the heartland, people that are in the technology sector, healthcare sector, educational sector, you name it, and they only get 60%. I mean, it's completely lopsided. The system is, you know, I imagine, you can give something to somebody of no value in exchange for 30 years of labor and a home. You know, you can rack up pretty quick power and profits by doing that, and it's a crazy system. So I think what they look for in presidential candidates of both parties, I think they control the election process in both parties, is people who are good at basically swilling the American people. They look for a used car salesman that have a good story and a good line and can sell stuff to the American people on some premise, when in fact the real intention and the real result is quite different from that.
Well, let's talk about solutions, Kirk. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think that in my own personal perspective, there are a lot of really good people out there that have studied the issues, that have proposals, and they differ from one to the other. And I think that's all healthy, to be honest with you. And nobody's always going to have the same opinion. And the reality is that just engaging in the dialogue is very constructive. But there's a step before solutions. And I think what will help to pull us all together, regardless of what your particular approach to the solution is what are the objectives? And I think an objective of the financial monetary reform is to take away the power from the people that currently have it and redistribute it back to the people. So whatever we do with the monetary system has to restore power, private property, and the American dream. We have to, in my opinion, do the same thing, and we have to restore honest and fair taxation. That's not what we have today. We need to restore private property. I believe that the Marxist philosophy of taking the private property from the people and putting it and taking it away has been accomplished through this combination of depressions, economic cycles, a death tax, and inflationary policies. We need to get it back. If people owned their properties debt-free and pass them on to the children debt-free, we would become a vastly much better financially off nation. We would rediscover the prosperity that should have been ours all along. We have to restore a stable, debt-free national currency, in my opinion, and we have to do all this without destroying the economy and the transition. So my particular viewpoint. There are those who advocate purely gold and silver, returning to the constitutional currencies. My opinion of this is that it's probably not practical. I am for gold and silver being legalized as money. I mean, consider this. I mean, it's pretty interesting for your audience to think about this. Gold and silver are the only constitutional currencies. They are constitutional. But we exist in a world where they're constitutional but not legal. How does that work? So first off, they should be and always have been a legal currency in our government and our legal system are way off track here. But I don't think that people are prepared to deal with a physical currency in all cases. I mean, imagine that you have to go back to the days when you walked in to pay your utility bill and you can't buy books from Amazon.com. I don't think people are prepared for that. And the second problem is I don't quite know how the Treasury gets, you know, I think Fort Knox is bare. How does the Treasury get gold and silver to even begin to generate that kind of currency? So I'm a proponent of a second category of currency, which starts in 1862, legal tender notes, United States notes. Now, this is currency that's issued by the government, printed and issued by the government. Simply by printing it, they start paying their employees and they pay their Social Security obligations. They basically start paying the bills using this currency without borrowing it. All of a sudden, we now have a debt and interest-free currency. And the government can actually even take this debt, or this currency, excuse me, and if it wants to not only pay its bills, well, why not go buy some gold and silver and put some back in the Treasury? Why not start paying off all these bankers off on their debts using this currency? We've been taking their paper now for nearly 100 years. Why don't they start taking our paper and force them to take it back and repayment of interest and debt, with a goal in mind that the federal government should be out of debt within 10 years. Now, in addition, in terms of restoring private property, you know, 95% of the homes in this country right today are in mortgage. I mean, imagine this. Here we are, a nation, the wealthiest nation on earth. How can we possibly have so much debt? And how can so many people be in debt? And I think I've explained why that's the case. So how do we get out of it? So the solution for federal is legal tender notes. Well, let's take the legal tender notes and let's declare a jubilee decade with all the priority of JFK's landing on the moon. I call it the jubilee decade. The intent is to get the legal citizens of this country out of mortgages within 10 years. And here would be the mechanism. And it would be voluntary participation. But here's the idea. The government would offer the choice to replace your current mortgage with a 10-year, 1.5% term note. And they would, if you agreed to do this, and you'd have to make sure that the government, the terms and conditions aren't doing something we don't want them to do, but essentially a replacement for your mortgage, you'd be out of debt within 10 years and hopefully with no higher monthly payment. And they would go ahead, and the way this would actually be implemented is they would take these legal tender notes and pay the bankers to buy back your mortgage and then issue this term note. Within 10 years, people will be out of debt. Now, the program is not a handout, because if you default, you would, in fact, be faced with all the same procedures that you're faced with today. You know, you lose your home and people come back and reclaim it. So it's not a handout. The 0.5% is feasible because that's actually what turns out of the 6 or 7, or when I was buying a home, it was up to 20%. Turns out 0.5% is really all that's needed to what they call service a loan. That's more than plenty for all the local banks and for the mortgage brokers and for the people who collect your monthly payments and process them and, you know, process delinquency notices and so forth, is about 0.5%. So essentially all the people that are engaged in that part of the service continue to do that, and we continue to use the same rules and procedures that we do. So that within 10 years, we will be out of federal debt and we will be out of personal mortgage debt. We will have begun the restoration. We will begin to see a new renaissance in this country instead of the dark ages that we're in and are looking towards. As far as disarming the money power, I think we need to repeal the revolution of 1913. That means that we end the Federal Reserve Act, we challenge the legitimacy or end the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment both. And I believe that that is where they really perverted our country. That was a revolution is what it amounted to, that fundamentally changed the nature of our government, its relationship to the people. We could defeat those three things. And in the way that we don't destroy the economy in the transition is, once again, legal tender notes. If you have an Andrew Jackson that understands the financial system, you don't need a constitutional amendment. You don't even need an act of Congress. You can print legal tender notes on the authority of the President of the United States. There's historical precedent, and it's already in place. What that president will do is make sure that we know from history that the bankers have responded by retaliating and trying to bring the nation to its knees economically, and they do that by trying to pull liquidity out of the circulation. So the government is there with its legal tender notes, pumping these in and stopping printing Federal Reserve notes and removing those from the system, and they will be able to put the liquidity in that the bankers don't want to and keep everything humming along pretty well. All this hinges upon the election of the right president, and in my opinion, what we need in 2012 desperately is the next Andrew Jackson.
Well, you know, they tried to kill him a few times, and the ones that have done similar things since, like Mr. Lincoln and Garfield and Kennedy, all are dead. So how do we prevent that from happening?
Well, your audience might be curious to know, where did the, before Homeland Security was formed and unified all this, where did the Secret Service report? Now, if you were the President of the United States, into whose hands would you like to put your life? You know, you might want to have the Secret Service report to your office. Maybe you have them report to you personally. Maybe you have them report to the military. But probably the last place you would have them report is the Treasury Department. Nonetheless, that's where the Secret Service reports, is the Treasury Department, the same as the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So the first thing I would do, if it were me, is I'd fire the Secret Service, and I'd bring in some good old boys from the heartland and surround myself with those, and my life would be in pretty safe hands if I did that.
I got my list already set up on the ones I'd call.
You know, there's a lot of good Americans out there. You know, we just have to figure out how to get rid of the system that's put in place and bring them in. But, you know, there's a fascinating tape on the Kennedy assassination that most people haven't seen. I found it on YouTube one day, and I've incorporated it in my YouTube video. And that's in the Why Our Country Is So... in so much debt, why our country is in so much debt. There's a series of three seminars that have been converted to YouTube videos, and these are the ones that parallel the book. The seminar number two is the history, and it gets into JFK assassination. Before he turns the corner, there's a short video clip where the Secret Service people who are standing on the rear bumper of the president's car are ordered to stand down and get off the car. And the agents who were ordered to back away turn around to the Secret Service guy in the car behind with their arms out in exasperation. What? What are you doing? So they're actually ordered to stand down. There is on the car itself, designed into the bumper as a step and welded to the back of the trunk, are handles on either side of the car where two agents are supposed to be standing to protect the president from the rear. And they're ordered to stand down. I mean, I don't know more conclusive evidence one could have that there is something going on in that Kennedy assassination. I mean, I don't know who realistically accepts the standard view. And you're probably aware that of Executive Order 11,110, which he signed 5 months before that assassination, where in fact he began printing legal tender notes.
Well, he printed about a billion silver certificates as a result of that, didn't he?
Yeah, and legal tender notes. And so he basically starts and understand that, you know, that's currency that bypasses the Federal Reserve System, goes into circulation, interest, and debt free, and 5 months later he's dead. And like you mentioned, you know, you have a lot of presidents. If you actually look at my seminar number two, you're going to see the correlation between assassinations and renewals of bank legislation, such as the National Bank Act. Every charter period begins with the assassination of a president. It's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we got about 10 minutes before the rest of this gang is supposed to be joining us, who will also have some ideas on some of these solutions, by the way. They got their own ideas about these solutions. They believe that we've got to get rid of the whole de facto corporate structure in order to solve this problem. And, you know, they've got a point. And I think it's certainly something we need to consider and work on. But I don't believe we're going to accomplish any of that until we do get control back of our proprietary interest in our currency.
I think to accomplish that, it can only be accomplished if the people begin to understand the system, because the reality is the New York-controlled media, which controls all the television, 95% of magazines and the news wires, basically what we hear and see is all generated from there. They're not going to tell us, and we know for a fact that the Congress and the government are not going to tell us. And you have an odd situation, because I talked to many of the congressional candidates here in California, both congressional as well as Senate candidates. And one of the questions posed back to me by one of the candidates or comments was the following. You know, it says, Kirk, look, here's my problem. First off, it was a person very well-intending saying he's going to back and solve the solutions, and I believe that he had every single intent, but didn't really understand the monetary system, but was open to hearing about it, understanding it, proposals. Gave him my book, and it sat on his nightstand. My first edition had my face on it, so he stared at my face every night looking at this book. Didn't ever quite pick it up to read it, but he had it. And his comment was this. Look, I come into a meeting, and I've got 10 minutes to differentiate myself from all the people that are running. Not a person in my audience cares about the monetary system, so why do I would be wasting my time to talk about it. And I think on that is a whole heck of a lot of truth. If we want our country back, people have to invest a little bit of time to understand the monetary system and why this is so important. And this is the only mechanism by which we can perhaps get our country back. And so I suggest to your viewers, you know, watch those videos. They will do it for you. Read the book. And get on board. We now have, for the first time since, I think, Charles McFadden, I think we now have Ron and Rand Paul up there. They're fighting the fight and making some progress. And I think we have, the American people really don't realize the opportunity that's in front of us. This is it. This is the time. It's now or never. Get on board with Ron and Rand Paul and other good people like DeMint. And I happen to like John Kasich, of governor of Ohio, and others that are, you know, on our side. I think that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to do that. So I do think money has to happen. We may have some other successes first, but I think there has to be an awakening on this issue, and then I think things can happen very quickly.
Well, let's go to that fair tax issue. You mentioned, you don't say the fair tax, but you do mention a fair tax. That is one of the things we have to accomplish in the solution. And before I ask you to talk about that, I want to visit out, you know, talk a little bit about it myself. I got a brother that's starting to work on the fair tax down in Georgia, and you know, I've done my share of looking at the fair tax and listening to various debates pro and con. And there are a lot of good things about that. I think that the fair tax has some good things about it. However, if we recognize that the whole income tax concept is unconstitutional, that the 16th Amendment has never been properly ratified, and even if it was, the Supreme Court has said that it did not convey any new taxing authority, We're looking at a situation where it is a direct non-apportioned tax and therefore against the Constitution and should have never been allowed to be law in the first place. We're looking at the monies that we pay into the IRS that's called income tax, that money first goes to pay for the interest on the fiat that's being loaned to our government from these international banksters. How does going from an unconstitutional tax to a constitutional tax that we shouldn't have had in place in the first place, how does that solve a problem? Well, you've said that you would get rid of the Federal Reserve and all of that and get us back to a monetary system that's backed by the government, by intrinsic value, all of that. But the fair tax, what's your take on the fair tax, given especially what I just said?
Well, I'm not so sure I'm against it, but I'm not so sure I'm persuaded to support what's called the fair tax yet either. But I mean, when I say a fair tax, I'm not meaning the one that has that name going on it. Constitutionally, I agree with you. Taxes are to be paid by sovereigns of their states to their states. And then the states are to pay, if any, taxes to the federal government, and the states are to be represented in the Senate directly, so they have a direct say-so in how big that federal government is. I think if we, basically eliminate the 17th and expose the 16th, we'd back to the founding fathers' intent, and I have a suspicion we'd see that the federal government shrink real fast to very small, and that the system would now move back towards at least more local control and hopefully a lot lower taxation. It's interesting to ponder. When one looks at what really helps your life, the roads that you drive on, the curbs, the drainage, the schools, the libraries, these things are all paid for by the smallest tax, the property tax. The reality is, it's the local government that gets you the most bang for the buck, and they get the least amount of money. And so I'm a big proponent of, if we're going to have, we don't have a federal income tax other than that which is prescribed by the Constitution, and that even within the state, I like to see that money being back first. The money goes first to the community, and then the community has a say in how much it's going to release to the state, and the state has a say in how much it's going to release to the federal government. I think that would be a big move in the right direction.
To me, in order for there to even be a consideration of backing something like a consumption tax, it would require that we also chop out over half of our government, because most of what is in our federal government today, as far as the agencies and departments, are unconstitutional. That's outside of what the delegated powers are. We certainly don't need, for example, a Department of Education. That was a part of the subversion process that was put in place through the tax-exempt foundations as a part of the subversion of our society. Have you seen the lecture, or actually it was an interview by G. Edward Griffin of Norman Dodd?
Yes, I have. By the way, absolutely an excellent interview. And if he's listening, I met him in person and gave him my book. And, I just want to say I think G. Edward Griffin and others like him, who were the pioneers and took a lot of errors for what they've done, are American heroes. And that particular interview, if people haven't watched it, is something everybody should watch. If you go to my YouTube channel, it's there.
We do have some callers and one with their hand up. Would you like to take a question or two?
Sure.
Area code 901 has your hand up. Are you live?
Yes. Are you talking to me?
If you're area code 901, do you have a question or a comment?
Yeah. I am a district director for the Fair Tax. I've been working for this since 19. 97. I agree on the constitutional issues with any kind of taxation. I'm more of a George Shultz, you know. We don't need any taxes. We have enough money in our coffers to pay everything. But my take on the fair tax people are not getting interviewed correctly, and they're not getting a fair share. There was a group that went before the Senate, and there was one person there that talked about the fair tax. Five other people talked about flat tax or VAT. God help us if we have a VAT. The fair tax has nothing to do with the VAT. And I'm sure this person knows that the fair tax is unlike anything proposed before. It's essentially a consumption tax that pays back people for their consumption at their poverty rate. And I just think people need to know that. And if everybody goes to fairtax.org, you can get the details. It's a pretty comprehensive thing. It's been researched by one of the most wonderful people that I've ever known or talked to or blogged with is Kotlikoff, Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University. And he is a very renowned economist. He is not a Keynesian, which most of our economists that are running our economy now are. He is a common sense economist, rare in these days. And he said that if we put the fair tax, if we enact that, and it wouldn't be overnight, it would be over, you know, several years, that it would put jet fuel into our economy because it would pull all these overseas companies into our country. I mean, with no taxation, the fair tax would eliminate all corporate and private taxation. It would do away with any kind of tax on your paycheck. You would get your whole paycheck. And what people say was, well, it's going to have to raise taxes. We're going to have to. But the people that argue about it are still thinking in income tax styles. They don't realize that once you erase the income tax, the IRS, you don't have to deal with that anymore. But anyway, that's all I want to say. I don't want to take time up from anybody else, but the fair tax is probably the best solution we could have to our economy right now, the shape it's in. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. What part of the country are you from?
Memphis, Tennessee.
Memphis. I'm from Nashville originally, so.
Oh, well, Memphis is it's the armpit of Tennessee.
I wish I could argue with you, but I didn't want to say that.
I know, but I know you. We all know it.
Well, thanks for your comments, and I appreciate that very much. I want to say we've got a lot of our other guests that are coming on. We've been on for a little bit over an hour now, Kirk, and I just want to thank you for your time tonight.
Sure.
And I hope that you will stay in here and join in with the rest of this conversation. Feel free to comment. We've got Dwayne Moore. I'd like to introduce everyone to Dwayne Moore.
Before you do that, can I just jump in real quick and at least ask people, go take a look at the website, silentnomorepublications.com. And you'll find the videos in the book there.
And I have been putting that, by the way, in the chat room. I've been putting that that link for them to see that, and I do advise everybody to watch these videos that Kurt has done. He's done a marvelous job of these videos, and I really recommend that you get a hold of this book, even if you don't use it yourself. I highly recommend it. I think before, Dwayne, I open the floor for you, I believe someone in 303 has her hand up, and that may be a question for Kurt. So 303, I'm hoping that Kate's going to make you live and you'll be able to ask a question.
I think that's probably me. Gary, this is Gary Fielder. It's probably me from 303.
Gary, let me introduce you to Kurt. Gary Fielder is the one who did the lecture series that you can find at thegigisup.com, or is it .net?
Gigisup.net.
Do you have a question for Kurt?
Well, I just wanted to I've been listening. I didn't really want to ask a question. I just realized you guys were running out of time, and I wanted to just jump in there and thank you so much, Mr. McKenzie, for talking. And I just wanted to make two quick points, and then I'll just put my mute button back on. I think there are also two big things that we need to get out there. Number one is the money has to be spent into existence. So the reason there's no need for an income tax is the Congress would still spend the money into existence. They just wouldn't have to borrow it. So when you think about Obamacare, the reason we needed Obamacare is because you still have to convince the population that the trillions of dollars that you're spending have some value. So they had to come up with some plan, something that could literally spend trillions of dollars into the economy so that the bankers can continue to be satisfied. So that's number one. If we had our own currency, if the Congress took back the money creation powers, we could still have fiat currency. We could still have fractional reserve banking. But at least we would spend the money into existence without debt. And then there would just be an issue of inflation. And the other point I really wanted to make is the problem with a fiat currency that's not controlled by government is when it's in private hands, you can use fiat money to buy up the real assets. So I can only envision the Rockefellers just pulling up with their SUV and literally getting a pallet of $100 bills loaded in and, hey, Ben, how you doing? Good to see you today. Have a nice day, So that's why the audit, the Fed, is so important to see where all of that fiat money went and to whom did it go to so that these people could go buy elections, football teams, caves in Peru to hide out in. I mean, they're creating the money and then they get to keep it. And then they get to buy real assets. Now, that's slavery, because we down here have to work for, $12 an hour, $20 an hour, $50 an hour. And how can you compete with a set of elites that just, get to write a promissory note for $1 billion that never has to be paid out and have it wired over to their account at 0% interest?
Gary, just for your information, if you're going to stick around for this continued conversation, which I'm sure you will, you might want to either mute or figure out some way to get your sound clear. It sounds almost like you're on a speakerphone. And
yeah,
so anybody,
that, off. I'm sorry. Yeah.
We're going to have a lot of people on this call for the next hour and a half, and I just want to make sure anybody that's not speaking. That does have a live mic, please mute your phone so that we'll get as little distortion as possible. And thanks again, Kurt, and stay in the conversation here. I'm not asking you to leave. I want you to stick around because I believe there's going to be some good interaction.
Okay.
We got Dwayne Moore, live mic. We also have Jose that's on a live mic. Dwayne, would you like to introduce yourself and let the folks have a little idea about who you are and what this group is about?
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it. It was good for you guys to have us on. Off the bat, I'd like to tell you that if anybody would like to see what we're doing as we're talking, our website and our activity that you guys are going to want to find interesting. 20 minutes into this, you're going to be going, where's your website? Because you're going to want to see this. But go to assemblypost.com, A-S-S-E-M-B-L-Y-P-O-S-T.com. And on the front page, when you get there in red hypertext, there's something called Foundations of Freedom. And that is going viral around the nation lately. That's why we're here, because we put that together, not so much myself. I'm just sort of somewhat of a spokesman here today, and some of the other folks that are coming on will do most of the speaking. I'm just basically just acting somewhat of a producer here today. But Terry, Red, and everybody else on the call, I just want to let you know that we're going to have Schaefer Cox with us, as far as I know, so long as everything goes well. Schaefer's about, he and his wife are about due to have a baby any moment now, so if he doesn't make it, you'll know why. He had to rush off to have that happen. So Schaefer Cox is expected. Michael Donald of the Assembly will be with us. Kelly Russell of the Assembly will be with us. And again, they will be doing most of the talking. But myself, I'm the chair for the Assembly, and so I'm not very high up in the official capacity. These guys are much more lawfully educated than myself. But to give you a rough idea how it started, this last call you had, you're talking about real money versus fiat money. Well, we've got a real government versus a fiat government. This is just as much a phony situation going on in this country, too. And most of you know that already, too. I know I'm preaching to the choir with most of you. But there's a last deep layer that some people don't even know about, and that's the difference between a real republic and a phony republic, or de jure republic versus a de facto democracy. And that's what we're kind of going to try and get into tonight and show you how easy it is and how we are actually successfully doing it, taking this nation back into the original republic that this country was once started as by two strong, faithful people. And for the starters, let's just say the righteous came here from Europe to worship our true biblical creator freely. The wicked followed us here like leeches. They came to take advantage of the resulting prosperity that we had. And, of course, that continues over generations. And similarly, it's like it used to be that the media would scramble like crazy to get the interviews with the most hopeful leaders that were springing up here and there, so they could be the ones to get the scoop on the best leaders that really had the right ideas to get this country into stronger areas of freedom. But now the media want to get the leaders to scramble to get the best glorifying media. And that's why I'm talking to Terry Dodd here a couple of times this past week. He understands that we're trying to show the mainstream media that they don't have a monopoly on this country when it comes to showing people what we believe in. And so we in this sort of an interesting new network of people are going to try and show the media that they're going to be the underdogs here very soon. If we're standing upright, why would we not only openly want to support the upright leaders that we see around us? They have to be truly upright, not half in or half out of Satan's system, or it's not going to be worth anything. It'll be in vain anyway. So all this is basically, we understand on the Assembly post, those of you who are biblical people will understand that this all goes to the glory of the Father. It's biblically coming to pass. And we've seen this coming to pass, how it's fitting together. And I guess being somewhat of the chaplain of the group for the day, if some of you haven't read the chapter on the book of Zephaniah in the Old Testament, it's three short chapters you could breeze through in, 25 minutes perhaps. It's a very fascinating read, and it fits perfectly with the decade we're going through right now. The exciting part is, when you get to the very last verse of the very last chapter, it very easily says that we're going to win. It says this: at that time will I bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth, when I turn back your captivity before your eyes, saith the Lord. And folks, we don't do everything that's 100% perfectly scriptural, so we're not completely that way, because we make mistakes. But we're focusing on the Father, and we're focusing on His ways of bringing this country back to a common law republic. And that is something that is a fresh idea for a lot of people. But the folks that are coming on today have been studying this for many, many years, some of them even 35 years, when Michael did. And you'll see there's experience behind this that's going to be phenomenal. It's going to blow your mind. And hopefully, it's going to turn the tide in this nation. And it's going to be a milestone. It's already starting to show that. You'll hear some stories tonight from some of these guys that you guys are going to It's going to blow your mind. Let's just put that simple. So I don't know who else has made it here with us today. I'm Dwayne Moore. And if you guys have questions as you go or afterwards or would like to hear more of these upcoming shows with my friends, just email me at dwayne@bcmin.us, and I'll spell that. That's Dwayne, D-W-A-I-N-E, at D as in boy, C as in Charlie, M-I-N, which is short for ministries, .us. And having said all that, I want to thank these guys for having us on tonight. And I'm willing to take questions, or if you're ready to go to some of the other folks we brought on, you do what you guys want to do.
Well, Dwayne, I put that email address in the chat room so that people could see it, because I know that's kind of a difficult one for people to understand. And we're having a little trouble with your mic again. It's a little clearer than it was on Tuesday when I was talking with you, but if you could just stay close to your mic and make sure you don't talk too fast, I think people will pretty well be able to hear you okay. You're loud enough. It's not a problem of being loud enough. It's more a distortion.
Overmodulating, yes. Okay.
So are the other guys, are we waiting for them to come in off of that other meeting, or what are we?
Yes. And that other meeting ran a little bit on the late side, and so we are hopefully soon going to see them show up. If I have, you don't have them on the screen yet, Ben, I take it, Terry?
Dr. Kate is monitoring the switchboard, and she's letting me know when they call in and put their hand up. If anybody has called in that wants to speak, make sure you, because they can hear us now, but they may not be able to have a live mic, make sure you hit a 1 to let Kate know that you've raised your hand and want a live mic. So it looks like Schaefer Cox may be joining us. Schaefer, is that you?
Yeah, sure is. Terry, how are you?
I'm doing very good. Sure is good to hear your voice, my friend.
It's good to hear your voice, too. It's been a while since Continental Congress. About a year, I guess. A little over a year.
It's been November of 2009, Schaefer. It's been, we're, what, 14 months ago, I guess, 15 months ago.
Yeah, real good. Well, those were good times. Those were good
I'm
times.
Glad things have... I'm glad things have been really quiet and peaceful and that nothing's been going on up in Alaska during that time period.
Yeah, it's just been sort of, you know, domestic tranquility like the Constitution talks about. Just kidding. Actually, it's been more like hordes of bureaucrats. I think it said swarms of bureaucrats to eat out our substance that the Declaration of Independence talks about. He has sent hither swarms of bureaucrats. I think that's what it's been more like.
Well, Schaefer, I believe we've got a live mic on Michael Donald. And let's see, who else there? 253, that would be Kelly. Michael and Kelly have joined us. I'd like to introduce everyone to Michael Donald and Kelly Russell. Gentlemen, would you like to say hello?
Good afternoon, Red. How are you? This is Kelly.
This is Terry Michael. Dodd. Red's actually checked into a hospital tonight, and it had some fluid drawn off of a lung. He had a open heart surgery here about 8 weeks ago, and so he is not with us tonight. So we've got Schaefer Cox on with us. We've got Dwayne Moore on with us, and hopefully Kirk McKenzie's still there. Michael, tell us what's going on. You're the featured speaker at this point, and I'm sure Schaefer and Dwayne will want to jump in, but we need to hear what's been going on with you this week.
Well, hello, everyone. God bless you, and it's wonderful to be with you. Yes, been kind of an exciting couple of weeks. I'm not sure if anybody's been able to share with you what's happened over the last couple of weeks, but I serve in the capacity in this land, on this land, as a secretary of the delegates of the several states of the United States in the original jurisdiction. And as such, I'm the speaker for the delegates and the focal point for the contact of the men and women on the land for the de facto, just as Hillary Clinton would serve on the de facto side. And in that position, of course, it's a very targeted, high-profile type of role with a tremendous duty that I have to perform that is published on the web in that I hold in trust for the men and women. And one of those duties is addressing the issue of jurisdictional boundaries. There's a maxim of law that states every jurisdiction has its bounds. And unfortunately, the states on the de facto side are all federal enclaves of Washington, D.C., since Reconstruction. Reconstruction was Andrew Johnson proclaimed peace after the Civil War, and Reconstruction began a new war, and it's still in operation today. It is an illegal peacetime war, active war against the states and against the Constitution, and it establishes a jurisdiction that is under color of law that is based in, as a matter of fact, it is the 10-mile square of Washington, D.C. And what has happened is the 14th Amendment, at least in the southern states, particularly here in Alabama, in the Journal of the Congressional Record, states, fixes the date as 13th July, 1868, as the day of usurpation, when the military usurped authority over the state of Alabama. They did it when the men and women of Alabama voted down the Reconstruction Act and the Reconstruction Constitution, 79,000 to 70,000. They went in with bayonets, marched out all the legislators, and brought in carpetbaggers and quote-unquote Negroes to pass the 14th Amendment. They marched them back out and marched the legislators back in. And since that point, the all capital letter state of Alabama has been a reconstructed, extra-constitutional federal enclave under the color of law, which is why the blacks in that time were called colored people, along with non-treaty Indians and Chinese and other ethnic groups. And what has happened is all of the states have been brought into that D.C. jurisdiction under the Reconstruction Acts. And if you look in your state constitution around that period, you will find the word state or in the phrase in this state defined, and it means D.C. and the territories. So every time they bring an action against you and use the word person and use the word state, they are talking about a party in the jurisdiction of D.C., and that is not you. If you are a real man or a real woman, that's not you. And all of their statutes do not apply and do not even name sovereigns. They name persons. That is a very, very important point. So I've been meeting with the FBI for 8 months on a weekly basis and giving them all of this history and these facts. I also serve on the judiciary on the Republic and share the law with them versus the statutory enforcement scheme. Now, folks need to understand that in common law, there is no monetary fine associated with a crime. And a crime is a crime because there is a victim involved. In a statutory breach, there is no victim involved. If you run a stop sign or speed down the highway, that is strictly a breach of a private corporate policy. And there is a fine attached to it. Now, why is there a fine attached to every statute? It is because the statutory enforcement scheme exists for the benefit of the bankruptcy fund. And they're trying to revenue fiat currency from the Republic to the public for the benefit of the fund. And it is illegal to take my money to pay for your bankruptcy. And when you are in bankruptcy, you do not have jurisdiction over yourself, let alone me. So I've laid out all this history and all these facts for the FBI. And last Monday when I met with them, they gave me a clean bill of health, said I have broken no federal laws, broken no state laws. Well, in the meantime, we served some writs on the Supreme Court in South Carolina concerning some foreclosures. They immediately came out and declared that we were engaged in a sham legal process and sent those writs to the FBI where I live. And the next time I met with them, they asked us to explain these writs. Now, these people are investigators. That's what the FBI is, Federal Bureau of Investigation. So I walked through each of those documents. And the FBI found no federal or state actionable offense. So the state of South Carolina bogused up a warrant and perjured themselves on an affidavit and sent it to the Alabama Bureau of Investigation, who came to the embassy where I was staying and posing as utility workers, asking stupid questions about underground utilities, trying to figure out who we were. And once they did, they immediately arrested us and took us to the county jail and put me in isolation 24/7. They deposited me in a warehouse in a steel container with a toilet that was an open cesspool, and no access to showers or phones or access to our paperwork to prepare a defense. And I carry the documentation as to who I am and what I am and where I am at all times with me, and I grabbed that when they arrested me. And I had it in the property room at the jail. When we finally went to court, I insisted that they give us that paperwork. And we were able to enter all that documentation into the record. Well, during this week in jail, they gave me a stubby little pencil and no paper. And I sat down with a little pink piece of paper that I had that they let me write some phone numbers down from my free collect call, whatever that is. And that's all I had. And I just started praying, and I said, Father, I need to write a criminal complaint. I need to write a counterclaim, an affidavit, a summons, and a challenge of jurisdiction. I need some paper. And immediately, three pieces of paper came under the door, and I knew nobody in this jail. So I said, all right, game on. I started writing this documentation out, this challenge of jurisdiction, and an affidavit. And next thing I know, an envelope with a stamp came under the door. And in a couple of days, a guard came in, and he started sneaking me some paper. And they finally came in and said, it's time to go to court. And so we went to court and stood before a judge who permitted me. Well, first of all, we asked him if he had an oath of office. He said he did. We said, we accept that oath of office and we bind you to it. And then, after we did that, he permitted me to read this challenge of jurisdiction from a minister of a foreign jurisdiction into the record in a 93-point affidavit in which I addressed the entire history of the organic original jurisdiction and the takeover of the reconstructed states, and shared with them in that affidavit exactly what I just shared with you this evening. Well, that judge was going from the scriptures to the case law to the code, back to the code, back to the scriptures, and back to the case law. I mean, it was amazing. And he saw fit to go ahead and set bail, set a bond amount, which was raised, and folks were praying about this all over the country, and I don't know how they found out, but they did, and within 30 minutes, that money was raised, was fronted by folks who sacrificed their rent money and their utility money to get us out while they aren't in strife, while the iron was hot. And that was Schaefer Cox militiamen up on Alaska.
So it's even good to have a militia that's a few thousand miles away, huh?
Well, that's the whole point. In the affidavit, I addressed the creation of the court, which is recorded on the record in the Holy Scriptures at the book of Exodus, chapter 27, verse 9. It began at the tabernacle, and it was administered by ordained men with a chain of delegation of authority who were Levites. And those judges hear truth and fact. That's all. The problem is that the de facto or the statutory enforcement scheme deals with fictions, fictitious part of fictitious plaintiffs and fictitious defendants. Therefore, the common law venue is superior to the Roman civil procedure, Roman civil venue or jurisdiction. The Roman civil law jurisdiction is personal, and it goes with you wherever you go. That is why the Apostle Paul claimed Roman citizenship when he was being persecuted, wherever he went. The common law jurisdiction is tied to the land. It is bound, it is tied to territory. And when you are on that land, you are on a common law venue. I also established the fact that the assembly venue is ordained under the superior covenant in the book of Hebrews. It is mandated. It is not suggested. It is mandated. Do not forsake assembly. The Puritans, when they came to this land, after challenging the inversion of federalism in the church and government in England, gave up on England, wrote the Mayflower Compact, starting over on America. They were chartered as local assemblies, self-governing local assemblies, and the framers constitutionalized it and addressed lawful and peaceful assemblies in the organic constitution. And that's what we do. We have established our assemblies on the states. They have elected their delegates. The delegates convened, wrote a decree, served it on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Commander-in-Chief, and the U.S. Supreme Court, notifying them that the Republic is repopulated. We have elected our officers. We have competent courts. And you are a foreign jurisdiction to us. Well, we met, we got out of jail, and they gave us 8 days to appear in court. 8 days to put a defense together against an extradition hearing to South Carolina. And I got to tell you, our people bathed this in prayer, and I was literally up all night long for those 8 days. Getting all the documentation together, getting all the argument together, just building the evidence file. And we went at 4:30 the night before court and entered all that into the record. When we walked into the courtroom, courthouse, the probate court judge was standing in the hallway talking to the court clerk. And I pulled the court clerk aside and I said, "Clarence, South Carolina is running a process on us and they're trying to extradite us on a phony warrant and an insufficient affidavit." And he said, "What? What do you mean?" I said, "No, it's true." I said, "We were in jail for a week at Talladega County." He said, "Let's go inside." Went inside, date stamped all our evidence, and he said, "Give me the set for the DA." And he took that set for the DA and took it down to his office at 5:00 the night before trial. We were meeting and we were having trial at 9:00 in the morning. and we were praying about this. This is Wednesday. We had a huge prayer meeting Tuesday night on the call, on the phone. Went in Wednesday morning with all my peeps, and I noticed that the DA wasn't there. Now, this is the man that has to answer my affidavit that was entered into the record. So I leaned up to my associate, who is our ambassador, Gary Wayne. And so we've been trying to get a continuance all week, and we keep getting deferred to the judge. The judge is going to be on the bench. We need to try to get that continuance. So they brought out all these inmates from the hallway, and the judge asked them if they had an attorney. No. Do you want one? Yes. You know, you want us to provide one? Yes. And this went on for 45 minutes. Then they started calling the docket, and they called Gary Wayne's name, and he went up front. And the judge says, well, you don't want a lawyer, do you? Gary Wayne says, no, sir, I definitely don't want a lawyer. He said, but I would like some more time. The judge was already shaking his head yes, and the guy at the DA's desk concurred. They did not want to address this issue in court that day because the evidence that we put on them, all of the evidence of the statements that I've made on this call tonight are in the record. And one of the things that I did in that affidavit was invoke an Article III Supreme Court because I provided the evidence that I am a minister of a foreign jurisdiction with a chain of delegation of duly counted lawful authority to serve in that office. Therefore, pursuant to Article 3 of the Constitution, the state of South Carolina has to go to the Supreme Court as the court of original jurisdiction for action against me. And what all of this is a divine appointment, because what I'm going to do is take all of these issues against all of the men and women on this land, these foreclosure issues, these IRS issues, all of these issues, and establish these jurisdictional bounds in an Article III court. And that's where
Michael,
it stands. Yes.
Michael, I'm sure that some people at this point are going, what? because they don't understand how you are from a different jurisdiction. Probably don't understand how Gary Wayne got to be an ambassador or how you got to be a diplomat. Or, you know, you've obviously, you didn't come to this overnight and you didn't just suddenly declare it. I'm sure there's been an actual and notorious notice that you've put out there and a lot of paperwork that you've filed and declarations that you've made. And I don't think we want to take a whole hour on that, but I think you need to give enough explanation to some of the people that are listening to give them a little perspective of how you arrived at that condition.
All right. Well, here's the point. When the states were usurped and reconstructed, your constitution in that period has an Article 1, and that Article 1 is a declaration or a Bill of Rights. And in that declaration or Bill of Rights, you have the opportunity or the right to declare or decree your political will, what venue and jurisdiction you will be found on. What is your substance? Are you a real man? Or are you a fictitious person? All of the statutes that they have address persons, not sovereigns. They cannot address sovereigns because it is the wrong jurisdiction. Every jurisdiction has its bounds. That is a maxim of law. So when you decree and record that document, that is a political wall that they cannot traverse. But they do, and when they do, it is an act of war. Now, the men and women who have done so and assemble have elected their delegates record their minutes and issue credentials to that effect. I'm a delegate in Alabama, and I, of the body of delegates of the several states, I was elected as secretary. That is a chain of delegation of duly constituted lawful authority, which is required pursuant to the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Patdorf versus the state. When you establish that chain of delegation, that is your authority to serve in the office that they elect you to serve at. The problem is that the de facto side has a chain of delegation of duly constituted lawful authority as well, but it is the wrong jurisdiction. It only applies to their jurisdiction. Does that help explain it?
Well, you might give them some idea. Obviously, you did a lot of research yourself to come to some of this. I don't know if you've had a mentor or if you had a book like The Red Amendment or, you know, where you got your information, but I think it would be helpful for you to be able to direct some of these people that are listening to places where they can read about this or discover more about this and gain a better understanding of it.
Well, I got a great website for you. One of the things I addressed in my affidavit was the fact that I'm a scholar. I'm privileged to hold a master's degree in divinity, and I'm a scholar of Christian history and a scholar of American history, and I published these facts on the worldwide website at assemblypost.com. And when you go to assemblypost.com, there's a hyperlink there for a PowerPoint presentation that was created by our Vice President, Carmen Corrine, and myself, and posted, that's entitled Foundations of Freedom. And in that PowerPoint presentation, we lay out the entire history with the record. Now, here's the point. In court, the record is the acts of Congress and public law and international treaties that are written into our history. Those are irrefutable. And if you find someone who will take the stand and produce evidence to the contrary under penalty of perjury, guess what? They will be committing treason because the facts stand and they cannot be refuted. And that 93-point affidavit to this point, up to the day of the hearing, has not been rebutted.
This is Schaefer. Let me hop in here for just a second and give you kind of a 30,000-foot overview of this, because I couldn't quite comprehend things until I had a thorough grasp on jurisdiction. If you don't understand the different venues of law, then you're just going to be mad about all of the perceived defiance of the Constitution that these folks are doing. But you got to realize that they're not operating under the Constitution. That's why they ignore it. I mean, I just had a district attorney send me a motion barring me from talking about the Constitution in court. Well, then that obviously a constitutional court couldn't ban the Constitution. I mean, duh, that's a no-brainer. So we've got to have a grasp on the history of how we got here. So let me give you, without all of the facts and all of the technical stuff, just a super, super quick overview so that we've got the big picture and it can make more sense of the particulars that substantiate that. What happened was that during the Civil War, Lincoln came along, and the Civil War wasn't really so much about slavery. In fact, it wasn't about that at all. It was about state and individual sovereignty versus federal imperialism. And he started marching with his war, and the southern states and a lot of the northern states freaked out, and they said, what are we going to do? And they said, well, we'll just walk out. we'll just pull out of this federal government. I guess we learned our lesson. I guess the anti-federalists were right. We're just going to walk out. And on March 21st, 1868, the House and the Senate adjourned sine die, which is Latin for without a date. No plans to come back. And that was the end of the republic that was created by our founding fathers. That was the end of the government that was constituted by our founding fathers. That was the end of it. It died, or more appropriately, went dormant. So Lincoln had the rug jerked out from underneath him, and he said, "All right, well, fine. If you've taken away my government for me to make war on you with, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a company, just a corporation, and I'm going to make war on you with that corporation." And he did that with Executive Order Number 1. It was the Federal Municipal Corporation. And that is when we switched from operating under law and a de jure republic, which was the Constitution, and de jure means of law, and de facto means for lack of a challenge. So what he did is the republic died, and he said, "Well, screw you, I'm going to make a corporate look-alike and just keep going with it anyway." And that's when we switched from English common law to Roman civil law. That's when we switched from operating under the Constitution and law to operating under the corporate bylaws, which are statutes. What's the difference in a law and a statute? Well, a law is indispensably obligatory upon all mankind. A statute is only obligatory upon members of that corporation. So Lincoln, with his corporation, just keeps advancing. And not by any merit of law, but just by the might of the sword, prevails and starts forcing everybody to be a 14th Amendment citizen and a legal person. And so this is where he had this little, it was like a church split, you know, and he went on his own way with the corporation. Now, Ike. President Eisenhower totally understood this, and he commissioned the Eisenhower Study. And the Eisenhower Study came back after several years and millions of dollars with 13 simple words. The feds only have jurisdiction over themselves and that which they create. Now, how could you possibly fit into that jurisdiction, into that definition? You can't. See, and let me just contrast these, okay? The de jure republic operates under law. The de facto corporation operates under statutes. The de jure republic deals with real, living, breathing men and women. All right? The de facto corporation deals with legal persons, which are entities that exist on paper only, like a corporation. All right? In the de jure republic, you have natural rights from God. In the corporation, you have civil rights from government. In the de jure republic, you have English common law, which is a mechanism of defense. All right? In the de facto corporation, you have Roman civil law, which is a mechanism of domination. All right? These two jurisdictions are running parallel, and they have been forever, for the simple fact that Lincoln and his corporation could not destroy what they did not create. So the republic remained. It was just abandoned and vacant. And so they were never able to destroy the de jure republic and the Constitution. They were able to, all they could do was make a corporate look-alike. And they sign us up to be a part, for membership in their corporate stand-in government. Government is in quotes on that one, with our birth certificate. And so when Michael Donald is talking about your decree of political will and stuff like that, what that is that's you saying, you know what? I want to be one of we the people, not one of your legal persons. I want to claim original jurisdiction under the Constitution and all of the
the restrictions and protections that that lays out, not under the United States corporation. I want to be on the republic, not a part of the corporation. Now, here's the big difference. Okay? What Lincoln did is he took the Constitution for the de jure republic, and he cut and pasted that to become the bylaws for his corporation. So it's very similar. But here's the big difference between a constitution, an organic constitution, and corporate bylaws. With an organic constitution, it's all about original intent. If it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, well then, that's it. Period, the end. If it says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, then, well, there's no questioning that. That's how it is, forever and ever, amen. That's with the Constitution. But with the corporate bylaws that are administered by statutes and codes, original intent means nothing. It is the most recent action of the governing body that supersedes everything else. That's why you can have the Second Amendment, which says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but any time that Congress gets a consensus, they can infringe it, because they're not operating under law. They're operating under statutes. They're not operating under the Constitution. They're operating under the codes and the statutes. And that's why they can disallow the Constitution in their courtroom. They're not judges. They're administrators. And you go in front of these black-robed administrators, and you say, I am not a legal person. I am a man with natural rights. And so I'm claiming common law. So unless there's somebody that I hurt that I need to make restitution to, or a contract that I hosed out on that I need to set straight, then get out of here, because I don't belong to you. And this is the duality of jurisdiction that we have been rediscovering. I mean, it would be far from the truth to say that we are pioneers of this, but it is stuff that has been forgotten. And the truth forgotten often seems a lie to those who have no recollection of it, but that nevertheless it is valid and it is so. And we all know this is in our, we all know it in our hearts. And the truth is so simple it's understood intuitively. Lies are so complex that they can't even negotiate them themselves. They don't even understand them themselves. That's the difference in jurisdiction. Did that make sense?
Chamber, this was all addressed heavily by the Attorney General in his 12th opinion of the Attorney General 182 on June 12, 1867. If you get a chance to Google that, you'll get a real good education about the Reconstruction jurisdiction. 12 OP period, ATTY, GEN period, 182, June 12, 1867. Now the Supreme Court...
Give me that again. Give me that citation again, because I'm going to look it up.
12OP period, ATTY period, GEN period, 182, June 12, 1867. It's the opinion of the Attorney General on the Reconstruction Act, and the Supreme Court.
12OP period, ATTY period, GEN period, 182.
Right.
Right.
The Supreme Court has supported exactly what Schaefer's laid out for you in Rodriguez versus Ray Donovan, U.S. Department of Labor, 1985. The Supreme Court states all codes, rules, and regulations are applicable to the government employees only, not human creations in accordance with God's laws. All codes, rules, and regulations are unconstitutional and lacking in due process. In United States versus United Mine Workers, in common usage, that term person does not include the sovereign, and statutes employing it will ordinarily be construed to so be construed to do so. In United States versus Fox, since in common uses the term person does not include the sovereign, statutes employing the phrase are ordinarily construed to exclude it. These are two different, I don't want to use the word entities, but two different substances. A person is a legal fiction, and a sovereign is a man or a woman. Now, why did they create these legal fictions? It is because the government only has jurisdiction over itself and its creations, and that person is an ens legis, or created by law, entity that they can attach. They cannot attach to a man or a woman. So they had to create a person under the color of law. And it took from the 1860s to 1972 to bring all of that into place when they converted, in our case, Alabama to the state of Alabama in all capital letters. And that state of Alabama is a subsidiary satellite corporate venue of D.C. by definition in the Constitution of that period. Sherrar versus Cohen, there can be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of his exercise of constitutional right. Miller versus U.S., the claim and exercise of a constitutional right cannot be converted into a crime. Miranda versus Arizona, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rule in making or legislation which would abrogate them. U.S. versus Bishop, if you relied on prior decisions of the Supreme Court, you have a perfect defense for willfulness. Imbler versus Pockman, judges may be punished criminally for willful deprivation of rights on the strength of 18 U.S.C. 242. So the Supreme Court has validated everything that we have said tonight. And this is the record. Any questions?
Yeah, there was a question about a case back in 1833, Barron, and I can't see it on the chat anymore. It went out of my sight, so Alan may have to ask that question again. I think it was you, Alan, that put that in chat before. Are you familiar with a case, Barron something versus something in 1833?
Do you know what it addressed? Did he say?
Well, Alan, you're welcome to call in or put it back in the chat so we can see what Michael is asking. Barron versus Baltimore, or Blatmore is what he typed. I think he meant Baltimore. Alan, what was it pertaining to?
I can't say I recall it, but well. Let me back up a little bit and address this jurisdiction thing. In one of my meetings with the FBI, the question came up what my motive was. And we happened to be meeting at one of my alma maters where the Divinity School and Seminary is located that I graduated from. And I pointed over to that school and I said, "You see that school over there?" And they said, "Yes." And I said, "My motive is the same thing as Scripture, and that is peace. And the law of peace is superior to the law of war." Well, some people say that we're on opposite sides. Now, they understood this issue of jurisdiction. And I said, well, we may be on opposite sides, but I know where your heart is, and I know that you're interested in justice and righteousness and peace. And that supersedes these jurisdictional boundaries. I don't think you're anti-government, they said. And I responded, well, anti-government is propaganda language that comes out of your MIAC report and your these publications that come out of the facto side. The Kingdom of Heaven is a government. The Republic is established in Exodus 18 and in Deuteronomy 1. And lawful and peaceful assemblies are ordained in Scripture. So, how can you be a Christian, claim to be a Christian, and be anti-government? It's not possible. That's propaganda. So there are a lot of white hats on the de facto side, and the issue is, do you have the credibility and integrity? Do you speak with authority to address these issues? Because if you do, then they will understand. It's the same thing that Christ did. He spoke with authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees, because he spoke the truth. And that's all I do. And I told them, look, I'm an ordained minister for the Prince of Peace. All I do is speak truth and facts.
Probably.
And I just invited them to prove me wrong. And they couldn't do it.
Well, I believe our stream dropped off. And although I think we're still recording, for some reason BTR cut our stream off, even though it was supposed to run until 9:30. I'm seeing in the chat room that they're not getting sound right now. I would suggest that we just keep going because I believe it's recording, and we will just keep on going here like they're hearing us. And anybody that I told them they could call in on the number because they could still hear on the if they call in.
All right,
I have a question.
Yes.
This is Kirk. This is fascinating stuff, and stuff that I'm in the middle of trying to understand right now. I didn't understand the one quotation here, though, or the reference, this 120.attty.gen.182.
Yes.
I did a search. I couldn't find it.
All right. 12OP. Period, ATTY, GEN dot 182. ATTY.
That's not a URL. That's a reference to some kind of document or something?
Yeah, that is the 12th opinion of the Attorney General on the Reconstruction Act, June 12, 1867. Now, the Attorney General's name, if you know about this man in history, he was not popular with the with Congress at the time because he opposed all of their actions. That Congress was outlaw, and this man was the Attorney General when he addressed what they were doing, and he absolutely slayed them in 19 well-articulated points. His name is Henry Stanberry, S-T-A-N-B-E-R-Y, one R, Henry Stanberry. Might want to just Google Henry Stanberry, opinion on Reconstruction Acts, something like that.
Okay. All right.
All right, and thank you for bringing that up.
Any other questions? I would like, now that we're, I don't think we've got a live stream on the internet at the moment, but I'd like for Gary, are you still on with us?
Yeah, I'm still here, I think.
You want to tell these guys about your recent experience with the birth certificate?
What do you mean? You mean my 3 weeks ago experience? My 3 weeks ago experience?
Yes.
Yeah, hold on a second. My wife gets very sensitive about this. I'm going to step outside. I had a baby 3 weeks ago. Oh, she's just so tired. I can't convince her that this is the right thing to do. So, there's no way that I could convince her, not that I would, because I think that one thing about being sovereign is, you know, why does a sovereign have to suffer in poverty? Why can't a sovereign take his wife to a hospital? Do you see what I mean? I mean, I don't understand that. So we chose to go to the hospital, and it was actually very wonderful, and they were very professional people. And for 2 days, we got the best advice and the best medical care. And at the very end, the lady came in, and she had all the paperwork ready to go. And I asked her, I said, has anybody ever said that they don't want a birth certificate? And she said, no, no one's ever said that. I said, you've got to be kidding me. You're telling me that one, not one patriot person has ever said, hey, I don't want a birth certificate? And she honestly said, no, I've never heard of that in my life. And so I said, how long have you been doing this part of your job? She said, well, I worked for the hospital for 10 years. I've been doing this for about 2 or 3. I said, well, there's a whole group of us out here that don't like these things, and we really don't like it. And I read the form very carefully. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, the form says you're going to give your baby away. And it doesn't say that at all. But if you, at least the one in the state of Colorado says, if any errors or omissions are made on this form, you hereby designate the hospital to be your legal representative to correct those errors. And she said, so that just means if I check the wrong box or I make a mistake, that we can correct that mistake. And I said, you know what that means? That means you can correct the spelling. Because we spell the name of this child, which I'm not going to give you, but we're going to spell the name of this child in a certain way. And then when you go into your computer program, you're going to be my legal representative to change the spelling of that child. And she said, well, because I said, because you're going to change it to all caps. And she goes, well, the program on the computer only allows me to use caps. And I said, now, you must have an outdated computer, because my computer allows me to type words in upper and lower case. So you've got a computer that only types in upper case, huh? And she goes, well, no, only on that part of the program. So I said, well, we're very nice people, and we're very respectful people, and we're very law-abiding people, but we're not going to sign the form. And I'm a lawyer, so I know I have 10 days to go down. You just let me, you know, go down there and deal with it. And she said, okay, I'm going to record. You know, my wife's name is McNair, which, by the way, is, you know, capital M, small c, capital N. I mean, you know, it's got two capitals in it. We're going to record this as baby McNair. And I said, well, where's that going to be recorded? And she goes, in our hospital records. I said, it's not going to go to the state? She says, no. No, if you go to the state, they can pull it up as baby McNair. And we walk that baby out of there. Now my wife's all been out of shape, just dying for a birth certificate. I'm trying to convince her not to do it, but trying to articulate all these arguments. But I don't think we're going to do it. I know I'm not going to do it. I know I'm not. But they did, because they do know what they're doing, because when the baby was born, the doctor signed the heirloom certificate, the nurse signed as a witness the heirloom certificate. They put the baby's feet in a little ink thing, and they put the feet on the heirloom certificate, and they don't fill the name in. They give you the heirloom certificate for you to take home and fill it out yourself. And then they have a spot for the mother's thumbprints, which I suggest people do in blood because there's DNA on that. But then you take home your heirloom birth certificate, and that's your birth certificate. So when you sign your kid up for volleyball or, you know, whatever, Little League baseball or whatever, take the heirloom certificate. Most of these organizations will tell you that's not good enough. And then you just have to stand by it and say, well, this is all we got, and this is all you're going to get. And this is signed by the doctor and the nurse, and that's my wife's thumbprint, and that's my baby's footprint. And they did fill in the date, and we filled in the name. And so, I don't know. We got this. We're 3 weeks out, so we'll have to see how it goes.
That doctor is an officer of the state.
Yeah. I think we have the birth certificate, the heirloom birth certificate, which is... That's it. I don't need an all caps vital statistics birth certificate.
Right.
Now we'll have to get there when she gets. You know, I don't know. I also think that a sovereign ought to be able to get a driver's license if he or she wants a driver's license. But I guess we'll have to deal with that issue in 15 years because I made the mistake of signing my first two children up, and so I didn't know better. That was, you know, my youngest child was 9 years old. I didn't know 9 years ago. You know, I've only
right.
come to this information about 5 years ago, so
right.
I didn't know better then, but I know better now. So
well,
I'll have to deal with that driver's license issue when we get to 15.
Congratulations.
But it was good. Just could get the
this
bottom
is Schaefer.
Line is you can get them. If you're a patriot, you don't have to have your children at home. You can get them out of the hospital. All you got to do is just be real nice, and what are they going to do?
Or you can be real mean too, you know.
You can be real mean.
When we had our first one, we said, "Look, lady, the only paperwork we're doing is green, so get out of my face." And
That's right.
Here's what they were doing when they were filling that stuff out. They were creating right there a legal person on that paper, and
exactly
they were making that little sovereign baby that was created by God. They were signing up your baby without its knowledge and consent to be the administrator and surety for that legal person. The administrator means
that's right.
they could
yeah.
that they can conduct the affairs. It's like they made a little one-man band business entity and then signed up your baby to be its manager without
that's
your baby's
exactly right.
knowledge or consent. I think that the very least you can do is to not do that stuff because when your baby is of age, they can make their own decision and decide if they want to sign up for corporate membership and do all that stuff. It's a piece of cake to do after the fact, but it
that's
is
exactly
a,
what
a
I told my wife. I said if she's 18 years old, then she has the adult decision as to whether she wants to become a member of, you know, the corporation or not.
You know what I thought about doing?
I know what Carrie wanted me to say. I'm sorry. There was a spot where, although this lady looked blank and claimed ignorance, she did look over at my wife because she thought I was one of those husbands that was just a complete sexist asshole. She did look over at my wife and say, "You know, if you don't do this, you won't qualify for any state services." So she did know exactly what the hell she was talking about because I looked at her and said, "We don't want any state services." And that's when she
did.
So
let,
you're
let
right.
Me,
the kid can't go to public school. Now, that's right. Now, that is right. Now, the heirloom birth certificate will not work for public school. Now, that's for sure. You know, so if you do it this way, you don't create an entity, but you can't. You might be able to get past Little League, and you might be able to get past gymnastics and volleyball, but your kid ain't going to public school. That's for sure. Because they will double in
thing.
The birth certificate. And that's a great thing. That's absolutely great.
Well,
thing.
Let me tell you something. If you pay taxes to support that school, they can't keep you from going to that school.
And that's, that's an argument down the line. Because, again, a sovereign ought to be able to send their kids to any school they want to because they're paying in some way. So
let me ask you a question since you're a lawyer. This issue of a driver license, okay? If you have to have a driver license to get a job, that is economic duress. And it's my opinion that duress does not change your consent. What say you?
Don't get me started on the driver's license. It's just... we all know what the answers are, and I'm just going to repeat what you already know. But in the end, I go back to my same thing. If you are a sovereign, you still ought to be able to interact with government in the way that you want to interact. So if you want a driver's license, you ought to be able to go get one. But you and I both know that you don't need one. You shouldn't have to have one.
Correct.
On the other hand, look at me. When I was born in 1963, my parents signed me up. So it's very difficult to get unsigned up once you're... I went to law school and didn't even realize my bar card was spelled in all caps until I looked at it 5 years ago. You know what I mean? And I paid taxes for many years until I realized that I wasn't making any income. And then so it wasn't that I stopped paying taxes, I just... realized I wasn't making any income. You see what I mean? So, you know, I mean, once you've engaged in society for years and years and years, it's very difficult to then say, I want to give back my driver's license. I want to give back my Social Security. So part of it is this educational process that we're going through now so that we don't make these same mistakes for our children. So the issue for me is I'll probably just stick with my driver's license. The issue for my little three-week-old child is she doesn't need a driver's license because she never signed up. Do you see what I mean? So for us, we're at an extraordinary disadvantage. Now, Schaefer's got a little bit of an advantage being from Alaska, but when you live in these big urban centers, you get pulled over all the time. When I stopped registering my vehicles, I got pulled over once, twice a week. It was horrible. You know what I mean? So it's very difficult to educate these police officers on the side of the road when you're getting arrested, when you're getting stopped, when you're getting asked for these documents that you don't have.
That is a valid point. And the FBI has asked me to put training together for these local cops, which I agreed to do because I've got some deputies and cops that wear white hats and they understand what's going on, and I can address that from the inside and from the lawful side. But the problem is, and these guys are always going up against their departments and they're going on under psyche valves and everything else, but the issue is they're going to do what the judge orders them to do.
Exactly.
So the whole issue has to be addressed among the judiciary. And that's why this opinion of the Attorney General is so important, because he addresses, and I quote, that the deceit revealed in the opinion is worth study for all. It shows clearly that the states were never reconstructed in the form in which they existed antebellum.
Now, can I ask your opinion real quick? What do you think about states that later joined the Union? I did some research on the state of Alaska because I'm from Eagle River, but you know, it seemed like to me that when they became a state, they were state of Alaska from the start. You see what I mean?
Yes.
The state of Colorado, which I presently live in now, it seems to have been created even in 1876 as state of Alaska. Not all caps, but still, state of Colorado. Not all caps,
correct,
but still state of Colorado. You know what I mean? And
well,
of course, you're from Alabama.
Here's my opinion on that.
You were previous to the Civil War.
Yes, and we actually, in Montgomery, Alabama, was the capital of the Confederacy. And when the Confederate states left the Union, they immediately constitutionalized, and they were the only de jure nation between the two.
Uh-huh.
But, yes, my opinion on that is this. You have historical records that clearly reflect the will of the people, and that is the authority.
And all the constitutions, all 50 of them, start with "We the People."
Right.
Can I jump in with a question here?
What is the record of what the will is of "We the People"? And that is the people are the state. And what I was addressing here in antebellum, the states were bound by allegiance and obedience to the word of God. By consociation, postbellum, they were united by submission to the commander-in-chief at Washington, D.C., thus altering the political relationship among them and their political relationship to Washington, D.C. The state governments of the South had therefore lost political standing in relation to the North, thus removing the possibility of bringing a political question to the courts. Abowitz and Company versus Price. And the Reconstruction Acts were viewed as military measures during peacetime. That's an act of war. In aid of the welfare of the inhabitants, since it was outlaw governments of the South that brought the actions. They were considered outlaw governments because they had not been reconstructed in the image and likeness that Congress decreed. What Congress decreed matters not. What the people, we the people, decree matters. That's the law. What do we the people say? And that's the issue that you're addressing in that question.
Can I jump in with a question?
I would also encourage you guys to start looking into the way that the Indian lawyers are exerting their sovereignty. because they're just coming to it, and they're realizing that when they interact with states and that when they interact with the federal government, they are most certainly interacting as foreign jurisdictions, you know, as separate, a sovereign foreign jurisdiction. And they
that
actually get up, you know, they because they got, because no one questions them. Do you see what I mean? Because it's obvious
that
they are foreign sovereign jurisdictions. So they're really developing some good tools in terms of show cause citations and their own orders and filing of foreign judgments and things like that. So I'm really trying. It's amazing that the Cowboys and Indians may have to come together on this. But it's amazing some of the work that the Indian lawyers are doing, too, in terms of this issue of sovereignty, where no one questions their sovereignty, you know?
That is a very valid point. I was the oldest of eight children. Five of us were natural born to my mother and father, and we adopted three from, they were Potawatomi Indians from the state of Michigan. We adopted them, but they were wards of the state at the time. They were children of a distant relative of my father, and they were 2, 3, and 4 years old. The adoption was final when they were 22, 23, and 24, and it is exactly, it is because of the issue that you just raised. The issue of dual jurisdiction is not new. It has always existed since the Reconstruction. And probably before with that.
I'll give you a good example in terms of the criminal cases. There are oftentimes where it started with the, you know, the ability to remove a custody case to the tribe, you know, and override social services or, you know, a juvenile court wanting to take jurisdiction over an Indian child. So, you know, the Congress passed laws allowing these tribes to remove the case to the tribal court. So when you guys go about establishing your own courts and one of your members, one of your people are in a corporation court, start looking into removing the case, you know?
Oh, we do that all the time.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward. I met Schaefer for like 5 minutes. Up there in Illinois. I was just stopped by for a couple days because Terry was there, and I was really interested in seeing what all the delegates were doing. But I haven't had an opportunity to keep going with my relationship with him, and I just heard about you tonight, and I heard that you got arrested a couple weeks ago. So I really wanted to not miss this call, and I'm really looking forward to interacting with you guys. It's been very, very difficult on me learning all about the officer of the court and what my right. I thought I was doing the right thing, you know, many years ago going to law school and fighting like hell, and I kind of find out, you know, I was just helping,
well,
you know, as I told Schaefer when I met him there in Illinois, I feel like I'm the guy on the slave ship, Doc, you know. Just,
well, let me tell you something.
You know what I mean? Say, come this way, come on this way, everything's going to be okay, you know, you're going to get sold to a good master, he's going to be kind to you, just come this way, you know what I mean? So I
let
really realized
you,
my role
is
tough one.
No, your role is an important one because one of the things that I do is I send a notice of liability privately to the other party. And after they acquiesce in that notice of liability, they are agreeing to removing the case and then canceling it and having it heard in any court in America. So we hear the case in our common law court and our local assembly, and we issue a judgment. And then we send a lawyer in behind who the judge will listen to and tell them, this matter has already been handled privately, and if you proceed, you're subjecting this matter woman to double jeopardy.
And that's what some of the tribal courts are doing. Yeah, I represent a couple tribes, and they're really on the cutting edge of that. So we got to talk further. Another thing I want to talk about is I'm representing a patriot right now who's in prison, and he's in the Tenth Circuit. And although he was shut down pro se the entire way with his arguments, and of course, he was writing pro se pleadings, which may not have been the most artful things in the world. He still wrote them. And now I'm in the Tenth Circuit, and this is big time. You know, he got convicted at trial, but now I'm in the Tenth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals, which is where you're supposed to get a little love over this. You know what I mean? And
right.
I'm coming to the Tenth Circuit as an officer of the court, but I still have to make these sovereignty arguments, or my client's going to go, you know, crazy. I'm not going to talk about it tonight, but I really... I'm going to get your email from Terry, and I know you're so busy, but if I could just get maybe an hour of your time or two, I want you to help me with my argument that I'm a, because I mean, this is going to have to be a reported decision. All, you know, Court of Appeals decisions have to be reported. So they're either going to have to call it frivolous, or they're going to have to totally ignore it, or they're going to have to answer to it. And he made a pretty good record.
Yeah, I'll be happy to talk to you about that.
Because, you know, he filed all the documents, and he followed all the procedures. Very aggressive in court. Very aggressive in court. And, of course, that got him shot down. That was the whole point. The judge went to war against
him. Let me tell you something. Let me give you another example of this jurisdictional bounds. The Mormons went to the New Mexico Territory, which was without the U.S., and established their land. And the leader of the Mormon church does not meet with church leaders. He meets with international leaders.
Wow.
So this issue of jurisdiction is nothing new. I mean, this is well-founded in law.
Yeah. It is. It's all about admiralty and, you know, basic chattel. And, you know, you just bale of hay, I guess. So, all right, well, gentlemen, I'm going to have to hang up because I've got to get to my wife and my child, and I've been on the phone here for about 2 hours. In fact, my battery's about running rid of it without you. So good luck in your endeavors there, and Godspeed. And if you ever need any, you know, if you just want to talk to somebody, when I email you, you'll have my email and my phone number, and look forward to talking to you fellas.
Well, I've got some counseling advice for you. You know, there's an issue over this birth certificate.
I'm sorry, one more time.
I have some counseling advice for you. If there's an issue over this birth certificate.
Uh-huh.
I went to a friend's house one time and asked her husband where he was, and she said, "Oh, he's out in the barn." And I went out there, and he was singing to his John Deere. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, we've been having these intimacy problems, and the therapist said I had to do something to, romantic to attract her."
That's a good one. All right, gentlemen. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Gentlemen, this is Dr. Kate, the host this evening and producer. And he has dropped off, unfortunately, and so we've got about 4 minutes left and would like to just ask you to have some closing thoughts. And when you hear the music, it's time that we will close this evening. On behalf of Terry Dodd, thank you so much for joining us. Please, gentlemen, your closing thoughts.
Well, thank you very much for having us on. I guess my closing thoughts are this. I've been looking at this stuff for 35 years. And we have really been successful because of the assembly, the ordained assembly venue. And in my meetings with de facto personnel, this is a very real issue. And it was exactly how this country was started. If you study the original jurisdictions of the original colonies, every one of them were chartered as local self-governing assemblies. And when the Crown encroached upon that, the Reverend Ezra Stiles and Samuel Adams backed them down with moral arguments because the Crown had acquiesced for 30 years and let them operate as local self-governed assemblies. They were attacked initially commercially because the Americans were producing quality goods, and they got into the pockets of the merchants in England, and they were attacked with the Navigation Acts and the Townshend Acts, and then they were attacked politically by the Tories, and finally they were attacked militarily when they started talking sovereignty. But this is a very valid issue, that the venue and jurisdiction of the local assembly, lawful and peaceful assembly, it was constitutionalized, and it's what, look, corporations and organizations, unions organize, men and women assemble. And that is very, very important to understand that. That word ecclesia in Scripture means to gather or to assemble. It was used initially militarily And the Apostle Paul borrowed that and applied it to the church. And that's what it's all about. That is your jurisdiction. That is the jurisdiction of a man or a woman, not an religious, created in law person. Schaefer?
Well, Michael, this is Kelly here. Can you hear me all right?
I can.
I'll tell you, you guys, you and Schaefer said it about as well as it could be said. I don't have anything to add to that. I just take my hat off to the way it was presented, and you made it right on track. I want to acknowledge the Father and the calling that he's placed upon the men and women to come together and to seek his face on some very particular issues. And that is what's really the driving force behind the men and women assembling and bringing this forward properly. And Michael, would you just lay out the issue of the garden and coming full circle with the Republic?
The Garden of Eden, you mean?
Yeah.
What is the issue?
Well, I guess I kind of sandbagged you with that. That just the wonderful way that you've laid out about redemption and the Republic coming full circle and being the will and how the Father originally orchestrated things. I sandbag you, Michael. Your mind is a different direction. I apologize for that. And I guess we'll just leave with those closing thoughts. And we just want to thank you guys so much for having us on tonight and allowing the people to understand what's going on here and where our rights and remedies are and how we can achieve those rights and remedies very peacefully and by the people coming together. We're looking to organize and unite 10 million men and women of peace and courage to move one direction. And this is going to be a very quick fix on this country and very peaceful fix once those 10 million people come together.
I agree, and we'll see you all on assemblypost.com.
Yeah, this is Schaefer. I would encourage everybody to go onto assemblypost.com and read through the Foundations of Freedom slideshow. That's super informative and super concise, and that'll help you wrap your mind around this. And I guess my closing thoughts would be this. We all see that there are things horribly wrong around us, and we're deeply troubled by those. And we have a choice. We can either try to compete for position within this corporate statutory Roman civil structure where might makes right and the mighty rule the weak. We can try to reform the form of slave management that we are living in. We can try to make this pagan nation a righteous one by force. We can try to change it, a regime that operates under the rule of force. We can try to change that into something that operates under the rule of law. But I don't think that that's our calling. God never commands his people to go into a pagan nation and a pagan system and to reform it. He calls them to courageously follow him out of a pagan system, of a wicked, oppressive system. And we all want liberty and law, and that comes from God and from his word and his law. And so my appeal to us is to not try to change the powers that be, but to come out of them and claim original jurisdiction and separate ourselves from them, those of us who believe in liberty and law, and live under the rule of law and under original jurisdiction, under the Constitution, not under their statutes and codes, and as much as it depends on us, be at peace with all men. We're going to offer them an olive branch with an iron fist and say, look, guys, we're not here to mess up your system. We're not here to rodeo your elections. We're not here to change how you manage your slaves, but we are checking out. So we're bowing out graciously. And if you interfere with us bowing out, we're going to kick your teeth down your throat. So let's be friends so we don't have to go there. And,
broken like our commander-in-chief. No, you cannot convert a corporation to a republic. You're fixing something that does not belong to you. That's why there are two seals on your money. The seal of the Republic and the seal of the Federal Reserve Bank. They are two different jurisdictions.
One is of law and one is of statute. One is for men and women. One is for legal persons. One is superior and one is inferior. One is abandoned and one is active. But the one that is abandoned, the de jure, the lawful one, is abandoned no longer. It's happening. It's nature taking its course. That which was based on flawed ideas is crumbling, and that which was based on true ideas, the republic, the de jure, the rule of law, is showing itself to be resilient. It is happening separate from all of us. We are helpless to speed it up or slow it down. The only decision that is ours to make is whether or not we will participate in the republic returning to her glory.
Well said.
Well, folks, this is Dwayne. And if anybody out there would like to get some more information on when these guys will be speaking, that's on our network of hosts and shows. Again, email me at Dwayne@bcmin.us, and I'll get you all the information you'd like to have. That's Dwayne, D-W-A-I-N-E, at bcmin.us. Thank you, Ben.
And this is Schaefer Cox up here, Fairbanks, Alaska. If anybody wants to keep up with what we're doing here, you can get up-to-the-minute updates on Twitter. Just look for 00 Schaefer Cox on Twitter. And also, we keep things pretty current on YouTube. If you want to check us out on YouTube, you can kind of keep tabs on Alaska via YouTube and Twitter. Well, good night, guys, and Godspeed.